Very excited for today's special episode. It's a man I've been talking to for years. It's Robert Frederick from the Hidden Life is Best podcast, and he's going to explain to us all about Shakespeare and why you need to care about it. Shakespeare was the OG of baking hidden symbolism into works of art, and he talks to us about what it's like to research Shakespeare, how there's a cult of Shakespeare, his inspiration for the topics, and we'll get into the Shakespeare hoax, connections to Stanley Kubrick and David Lynch, including a really cool story about how Robert actually met and shook David Lynch's hand. My God, so jealous. And the impact that Shakespeare had on modern pop culture. And then we talk about how it's very possible, even likely, that Francis Bacon was actually the guy who wrote all the Shakespeare plays, and how he was using propaganda and psyops for a British empire building, as well as some hidden Rosicrucian symbolism in Shakespeare's works, and this future that they've got planned for us of scientism, the Gnostic religion of the technocracy. We talk about Peter Thiel, the digital matrix, immortality, the whole works. So stay tuned to this awesome episode. This interview was great. I can't wait to get back on here together with Robert, because he's got some interesting ideas that you've got to listen to. While you're listening, go ahead and check out the show notes. I'm going to put a link to his podcast, which I highly recommend. I've listened to all of them, except for, well, there's a couple of new ones I got to catch up on, full disclosure. But for years, I've been listening to his show. His Substack and his Patreon are all in the show notes. Check him out. I'll hit you on the other side. Let's go. Major update, folks. I'm about to take all you globalists and lizard people down. Down Grifter Alley, that is. It's a Grifter Alley red alert, folks. I've got some new shirt designs now up on my new online store, occultsymbolism.com, as well as some major leveling up of the Patreon experience. Give me 60 seconds, I'll explain. The newest shirt design is the Donald Trump Skull and Bones logo on the front, and on the back, it says Epstein didn't kill himself. I'm going to put it up on the video version of the show for all you video version watchers, tier two folks. The if you want all the smoke this Thanksgiving, pick this shirt up. It's a limited run. I'm not printing these things again. Same goes for the other shirt now in stock, which was also a limited one-time run, but due to incessant demand, I ran one more printing of it. It's the George Bush Skull and Bones logo on the front with the Saturnian stuff on the back. All right. The back says, symbols don't kill people. Saturn death cults with symbols kill people. And also lower the prices on some clearance shirts. The gray podcast logo shirt. The back says, these nerds are going to kill us. Those are $9.99. The Twin Peaks Laura Palmer shirts, those are $11.99. And also, if you're on Patreon or VIP section, be sure to use that 10% off merchandise code. It works on everything in the store except for the coffee, because my profit margin is razor thin on the coffee. I'd be losing money if I give 10% off. Am I a great businessman? No. The shirts and the coffee are not lucrative business ventures, but I do those for the fans. And I say fans, my community, right? And I aim to give these premium products, so the shirts are always mega soft. The Mushroominati Watcher coffee is always mega smooth. And, it's either I peddled shirts, books, and coffee, or boner pills, or whatever I can score for a sponsorship that doesn't violate my ethical code. So so that's what this is. So if you're interested in getting your own shirt design printed out on some super soft shirts like I do, check out my man Dustin over at Bryant Prints. He told me he's got some room. I talked to him the other day. He's got some room to accommodate some new customers. He's a good dude. I've known him for years. He's been printing my shirts for years now. So if you like my shirts, you're like, dude, these are great quality shirts, hit him up. Hit him up on Instagram. That's how you need to get a hold of him. Instagram.com/Bryant_Prints. I'll try to put a link in whatever show notes, whatever episode you're listening to. But hit him up. And that's not a sponsor referral. He's just a good dude. He helps me. I want to help him. So check him out if you're interested in selling your own shirts. Doing your own Grifter Alley. And finally, major Patreon leveling up going on. If you're on tier 3 or tier 4, this applies to Patreon and VIP section, folks. Okay, so listen up. If you're tier 3 or tier 4, you're going to get all the same goods you got before, but I'm adding another one, an exclusive shirt that nobody can buy, nobody can pick up anywhere. I don't even have one, all right? Because I'm not a tier 3 or tier 4 supporter. I'm going to tell you what it is. It's the same shirt that you know and love. It's the black podcast logo shirt, super soft, but on the back is where you're going to stand out, because on the back of the shirt, if you're tier 3 on Patreon or VIP section, it's going to say Inner Circle, all right? And on the back of the tier 4 shirt, it's going to say Grand Architect because that's what I rebranded all my tiers, right? Back in the day, we used to call it OG Granola Woke, Alkaline OG Granola Woke, all that crazy stuff, right? But I've changed it now, and it's, you know, you've got all these other tier names now. And so tier 3 is Inner Circle. Tier 4 is Grand Architects. That's on Patreon and VIP section. So if you sign up at either one of those tiers, I'm going to send you this shirt free of charge. I'll pay the shipping and everything. I'm going to send it right to you for free, okay? I go through the sign-up list at the beginning of every month, so be sure to look for an email from me. It's the same email you signed up for the service under, so check that. And we'll communicate out the size and the address and all that stuff. So, and if you're already tier 3 or 4 and you're like, well, bro, where's my shirt? I sent you the email. Check your email. I sent it at the beginning of September, so write me back. I had a couple people already write me back. I already shipped out their shirts. They're already rocking it. They're already rocking the gear, all right? So, yeah, that's the updates on the shirts, the Patreon and VIP section updates. If you want information on any of that stuff, if you're like, what's a Patreon? I've got links in the show notes on my link tree, allmylinks.com/IsaacW, I-S-A-A-C-W. You're going to want to check that out. And that's where you can sign up for Patreon, VIP section, whatever you desire. And as well as my online store, occultsymbolism.com, where you can find all the other shirts. Okay, you get it. Thanks. Stay positive. Today we're joined by a man who's been on an unrelenting journey to expose one of the biggest kept secrets in all of entertainment, the truth behind Shakespeare. He's the mastermind behind the Hidden Life is Best podcast and Substack, which has painstakingly tracked a man named Francis Bacon, who he believes is the most influential person who ever lived. This interview has been literally in the years making, so join us today as we break down the real global history with our special guest, Robert Frederick. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Isaac.
You know, I feel like I know you already because we've been talking on email for so long and I've listened to your Hidden Life is Best podcast series. There's a lot to get through and I know there's not a chance that we're going to get through it in an hour. But what I'd like to start out with is knowing a little bit, you know, because we're going to nerd out on Shakespeare and Francis Bacon and stuff like that. But I got to know more about you, and I want you to share as much or as little as you want, because I know you're a very private guy. As far, even like, is Robert Frederick a pseudonym? What got you into all this? Do you have a red pill daddy out there that you want to say hi to? Were you a conspiracy guy? Are you a conspiracy guy? I have my suspicions. You know, maybe some formative interest growing up. Go as far back as you want. Give us, you know, a rundown of who you are and what inspires you and such like that.
Well, first of all, Isaac, I'm a fanboy of yours.
Oh, well, you are off to a good start. Flattery works great with me. So, yeah, thank you. I appreciate that because, you know, listening to your Hidden Life is Best podcast, like, you're a very intelligent guy for sure. So, like, I always like it when people are, like, really impressive to me that listen to my dumb ass. So, I appreciate that.
I remember your incognito days even.
Yeah. You were telling me that you used to read the blogging days back when I tried to make it blogging, but
yeah.
You know, yeah, thanks. Appreciate that.
I'm impressed. You're the hardest working man in show business.
Except for Sam Tripoli.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think Sam's got me beat.
Could be. That's right. He's got like 5 shows or something.
Yeah. He doesn't stop. And then he's on the road doing comedy shows. I don't know how he does it, but.
So it's been a lot of fun listening to you over the years. I'm a longtime New York City resident. I studied art. I came here for the art world and the intellectual ferment. And let's see, always wondering why the world was so screwed up when, you know, I traveled a lot of different jobs. Almost everyone I meet was decent, reasonably intelligent, fair-minded. Why is the world so screwed up? So, you know, studying history, reading. I always loved literature, studied cinema. Just trying to absorb, just always wanted to know everything. Just this artist, songwriter, like I even wrote a song once, I want to know everything, which I guess Jimi Hendrix did too. But at any rate, I started focusing on the British Empire as the cause of much of the problems in the world, which just started making more and more sense to me as I went along. And then one day I was listening to a podcast, Susquehanna River Alchemy by Michael Wan. It wasn't a podcast. It was a video he made and even had a map. And he started talking about, it was about Jamestown, and the founding of Jamestown on the Susquehanna River, which is a major river that runs through New York State, which I used to live on this river, and it flows all the way down to the Chesapeake Bay where Jamestown was settled. So my ears are pricking up because he's talking about the Susquehanna River, Jamestown, British Empire, right? It's the first successful colony in America in 1607. He starts talking about Francis Bacon, and he says Francis Bacon was involved in the settling of Jamestown. And my ears just pricked up because Bacon was already on my radar as kind of a key component of the British Empire, which I was really zeroing in on. And I said, okay, I got to look into Francis Bacon. And then this like crazy synchronicity happened, which I won't go into. I've talked about it before. Like just this earth-shattering synchronicity around Francis Bacon. And it was like, okay, message received. I'll study Francis Bacon. And I just started reading everything I could about him. And it was sort of like you're walking along and you see like a penny on the in the ground, in the grass, and or it turns into a finger and a hand, and you dig around the earth and you keep pulling it out. And it turns out to be a sculpture that's on top of a building, and you keep digging and there's a mansion, and you keep digging and there's just more and more revealed. And that's what it felt like with Bacon. Because not only is there overwhelming evidence that he was William Shakespeare, he's amongst normie historians known as the father of modern science. He's also one of the greatest lawyers in English history, who became Lord Chancellor, Attorney General and Lord Chancellor. But not only that, he's strongly associated with the Rosicrucians. And then what I found out is he's very strongly associated with Freemasonry. So yeah, dig into the conspiracy stuff, which I'm definitely a conspiracy guy. And the relationship of Freemasonry to conspiracy, and then the occult. And then you just dig further into Francis Bacon's life, and it was just like, wow, this is really, really crazy. And after a couple of years, I was like, I'm going to write a book, and why don't I just do a podcast while I'm writing the book? Because there's just so much information. There's like six huge areas of information, from the British Empire, from William Shakespeare to the birth of science to Freemasonry. They're huge topics. So I'm kind of swimming in this sea of information, just trying to digest it and put it out in interesting chunks of information while I write this book. And, I'm on a mission.
I respect that. Yeah, you do fascinating research in this because, like I said, I've listened to, I'm not up to date on Hidden Life is Best, but I listened to the first couple of years of podcasts you did on it. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting subject because the British Empire, which, I'm a public school student. I don't know much about English history.
Yeah. But
in the Jason Louv book about John Dee, it's rich in the history of the British Empire. And half the stuff they're talking about just goes over my head. I'm like, I don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And I find like a lot of the stuff you have to research is in that similar vein.
Yeah.
And it's interesting you brought up Michael Wan because he was one of my first guests. I imagine maybe you, I don't know if you heard our interview forever ago. I mean, I literally think he was maybe he had to be one of the first 10 guests for sure.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it's interesting because we bonded because he and I, I grew up in Lancaster, PA, which the Susquehanna River runs through.
Whoa, I'm getting the chills.
Yeah. So it's pretty crazy that you brought that up as well, because he has this sort of, from what I, going back in my memory banks, he had this whole idea about various sort of occult magical powers about the Susquehanna, because I believe he was from York, PA, which is right next to Lancaster. And it's interesting you bring that up because the Susquehanna runs up to Bainbridge, New York, which ties into something else we're not going to get into right now. I'm just kind of tossing this out there for now before I forget.
Lyndon Baines Johnson,
which is in the James Shelby Downard King Kill 33 document, because James Shelby Downard ties Lyndon Baines Johnson with the Baines clan, which comes through he thinks this sort of synchro-mystic connection to Macbeth, which is a Shakespeare play, which we've talked about on email, some of the ideas of Macbeth, which, let's throw this out here. You told me to watch the Polanski Macbeth, and I let you down. I actually put it on my little queue, and I saw that there was a newer Denzel Washington Macbeth, and I was like, okay, let me watch that. And I made it maybe 10 minutes, and I was like, bro, I don't even know what they're saying. I don't know the words they're using. It's very confusing for me.
Yeah, you got to watch the Polanski.
Oh, is that more like down to earth?
Oh,
all right, my bad.
Polanski's like, you're going to love it.
Okay, all right. Yeah, because Polanski's obviously very plugged into all that occult stuff. But
exactly.
I'll bump that up on my little
to do. It's kind of a must-see. Especially because the connection to Shelby Downard, which I didn't even know. And especially to the British Empire and everything we're going to talk about today. It's a great entree into the world of Shakespeare.
Excellent. Yeah, because virtually nothing about Shakespeare. I never read it. I wasn't into the arts or anything like that ever.
I didn't either. Somehow I escaped getting it in high school. My kids have all gotten it, you know, a lot of it. Most people do. That's part of the thing.
Oh yeah, same for me. I don't remember taking one English class where we talked about Shakespeare.
Yeah, and so I always wanted to. I was like, I got to know about Shakespeare. What do people mean when they say Falstaff or Iago? I need to know what they mean. Full disclosure, I did see Mel Gibson do Hamlet back in the 80s. You probably weren't born yet. That was the big movie.
I was born in 79. So.
Okay, so you were five. That's a good movie. If another good movie for folks, if they want to get into Shakespeare, is Mel Gibson's Hamlet from the 80s.
He starred in it or he like
he starred it? In it. He was Hamlet. I can barely remember, but I'm telling you, all the big stars got to do Shakespeare.
Okay.
Even to this day, Timothée Chalamet, Mr. Bob Dylan, he did Henry V and Henry VI just before doing Dylan.
Oh, Michelle really?
Pfeiffer. Like everyone has to do Shakespeare. Denzel. It's like, son, I didn't even know he did Macbeth, but he's doing Othello on Broadway right now.
Hmm. Oh, really?
Which, kind of demeaning for a black guy to do.
Why but is that? Anyway, I don't know anything about Othello.
Othello's the black Shakespeare play where it's supposedly about racism, but it's not. But this black guy kills his beautiful wife because Iago plays with his head so effectively. And Iago is considered to be one of the most evil people in all of literature. So those are one of the top 5-6 Shakespeare plays is Othello, you know, Macbeth, Hamlet. They're all super intense. They're super occult. And they're drenched in all this intense meaning. That's exactly what you do with pop culture now and the pop culture movies, the way you analyze them, I do with these Shakespeare plays. The difference being is that there's 400 years of heavy duty, high level intellectual criticism of these Shakespeare plays. That's way over the top. It's literally a religion. What I've discovered is Shakespeare became a religion. So
what do you mean? Like the critics or the scholars or both?
Oh my God. It's so intense, Isaac. They just love Shakespeare so much. I should have some quotes handy for what people say about him. He's next to God.
Interesting. Really? Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm still blown away. I'm still blown away. And I'm just now, let me just assemble the quotes. And very few people have bucked that trend. I mean, you can count two well-known intellectuals over the centuries that have said something's wrong with Shakespeare. I'm in that tiny little club, and it's like this enormous amount wrong with Shakespeare. And those two are Leo Tolstoy, the famous Russian writer, author of War and Peace, and Anna Karenina, one of the greatest writers of all time. He's one of the very few, and he was very public about it. Like, something's wrong with Shakespeare. Something's wrong. And he wrote a whole book about it, which I haven't read yet, but I've read quotes. So then all the critics are like, what's wrong with Tolstoy that he doesn't like Shakespeare? How could he possibly not like Shakespeare? So there's that one debate. And this other, a famous German or Austrian philosopher named Ludwig Wittgenstein, one of the top philosophers of the 20th century, kind of a hip guy, also is on record as finding something wrong with Shakespeare. Otherwise, it's virtual nonstop praise. And there's an essay of mine on Substack called Why the Shakespeare Hoax is So Important. And it goes through exactly how Shakespeare literally became a religion in England and America, primarily called Bardolatry. It became this nickname. And the statues of him and the books about him. And there's books called the Shakespeare Concordance, which I just found in a used bookstore. Every single word of every single Shakespeare play is listed in dictionary form and which play it's in and the line in which it's used. And there are whole libraries dedicated to Shakespeare, and you can get PhDs in Shakespeare. And if you want to study a play, you've got to get into that play and get the Arden edition. And they examine literally every word in that play will be examined, like where it came from. Was it in the first folio? Was it in the quartos? What does it mean? How does it shake out? Did he invent it? Because the guy was so phenomenal in terms of the number of words he invented. And what they found over the centuries was how much intense depth and density is in these plays, and how many ancient philosophers and philosophies and history and ideas are stuffed into these plays that nobody noticed for like 100 or 150 years, because there was no such thing as English departments. People didn't study literature. They just went to the plays and saw them. Mm. So that, yeah, it's literally, Shakespeare is literally a religion. I feel comfortable saying that.
Okay, so you think it, you would put it on par with how, you know, a Kubrick film that was made 50 yeah. years ago, we're still unpacking it, trying to find yeah. little hidden meanings.
Kind 100%. Of like Kubrick okay. studied Shakespeare. Kubrick's first film, where the guy's floating down the river, have you seen that one?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen all the Kubrick films, which is hard to believe.
He made it for $500, whatever. I think there might be one famous actor in it. It's a really good movie, but it's centered around the Shakespeare play, The Tempest. One of the guys thinks he's a magician, like Prospero on The Tempest, which is another super famous Shakespeare play, which has all this intense occult symbolism in it. But Kubrick definitely came out of Shakespeare, and that stuffing of symbolism in the plays is totally Shakespearean. And Kubrick's, yeah, obviously a master of it. Yeah, absolutely. It's exactly the same.
Okay.
Except instead of for 50 years, I would say it's been going on for, you know, in earnest, 150 years. Because the first English department at Harvard wasn't until 1870. So let's say 160 years, people have been tearing apart the Shakespeare plays looking for clues, the way you tear apart Kubrick. Exactly.
Okay. So
good comparison.
Okay. Okay. So so to try to like understand why people like Shakespeare so much, is it because I'm assuming you've consumed the plays in a variety of forms
yeah.
or so?
Yeah.
Are the stories like really like that great, or do people just pay homage, like, as if, you know, kind of like the Beatles, right? Like the Beatles was before my time. I can respect them for sure, and I can look back at the history of music and be like, oh yeah, I can see how they came along and sort of revolutionized the sound of rock music. I can respect that, but like, you're not gonna find any Beatles tracks on my playlist. Like, I don't listen to them, but I respect it. Is Shakespeare kind of like that, or is Shakespeare, when you watch this stuff and you really like kind of understand what he's saying, you're like, wow, this really is great. This is better than any Stanley Kubrick movie.
That's a really good question. I have a lot of thoughts about that, because it's not something you really like at first. It's an acquired taste. But once you get it, you sort of want to know more, and you want to dig in and know more.
Like, it's kind of like Twin Peaks, maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe. Did you ever watch Twin Peaks?
I sure did. I sure did.
Oh, you did. Okay. Okay.
I watched it when it came out. I don't think I ever finished it.
Oh, you're one of those.
Man, I remember telling you, when you sent out a tweet going, is this Twin Peaks worth it? And I clicked that like, not really, man. You know, it's really dark. It ends really weird. But of course, I didn't understand occult symbolism back then. That was the 80s, right? Yeah, I didn't know what I was looking at.
So did you finish the season two back in 1990, or did you?
I think I finished season two. I mean, back in the day, it was on TV. You had to turn on TV on Thursday afternoon nights or whenever it was on. It was great. No, I loved it. We all loved it.
But you couldn't get into season three, The Return.
I never watched it. Oh, by then, God. I mean, that was a few years later, right?
It was 2017, you know, 25 years later. And it's the best. The first time I watched it, I was like, I don't really know about this. And then was just like you're saying, the reason I'm bringing this up is because it's just like you're saying, I got through season three and I couldn't get it out of my mind. I just thought, what was that? That was kind of strange. But there was something there. It wasn't just weird for the sake of being weird. And, you know, now I kind of, if you had asked me to pick which season of Twin Peaks, I mean, I think I'd have to go with season three because I kind of think it's just a genius format of, you know, Lynch and Frost working in all this cult symbolism and messaging and sort of earworming a dream into your head is what it feels like. And you want to sort of like go back. It's like when you wake up from a dream, you want to go back in the dream. That's what it feels like.
Now that's an amazing comparison because I've just been digging into A Midsummer Night's Dream by Shakespeare, which I think is the core play for all this stuff, like the earworm thing, the way it grabs you.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure Lynch is a student of Shakespeare and some Shakespeare movies, especially A Midsummer Night's Dream. Shakespeare is really into dreams. David Lynch is really into dreams. I heard him speak. I met him.
David Lynch?
I have a signed copy of his book.
What?
Yep. Catching the Big Fish.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Shook hands with him.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Jeez. Jealous.
His teeth were messed up, bro.
Drinks a lot of coffee and smokes a lot of cigarettes, I imagine so.
And he gave me that smile. He gave me that weird smile. I'll never forget it.
That's great, man. Was he at a college or something? Or
no, he was at a bookstore in Long Island. In the town my mother-in-law was from, I was driving by the bookstore. There was a big sign in the front. And what's David Lynch doing here? He put that book out, Catching the Big Fish. Did he give a talk? No. So I saw that talk when he talked about meditation with Jerry Seinfeld. Have you seen that?
No, I've never seen that.
He's a big meditator. What's that called?
Transcendental meditation.
He's a big transcendental meditation guy.
Oh, interesting.
And so is Jerry Seinfeld. You can go on YouTube and they talk together. See, it's now it's like a dream. I'm like, was I there? Did I see them live? But I didn't. But I know that he gives a great talk about transcendental meditation. Jerry Seinfeld comes out and talks about it.
I didn't know Seinfeld was into it. Yeah, I've seen a video of Lynch explaining TM, and it's fascinating the way he describes it. And I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of every sort of Jungian thing about tapping into a collective unconscious,
right?
You know,
and he said he only got one idea for one of his movies from a dream. Everything
here,
that's what he said. Yes, he said one idea. I woke up from a dream and I had a solution for my films. I don't really know how David Lynch works. He's kept that a secret where all this stuff comes from.
I felt like, so I watched, I'm not a huge, believe this or not, I'm not a huge David Lynch fan because my first Lynch movie I saw as a teen was Lost Highway simply because I liked the soundtrack and I was really into like Nine Inch Nails back then. Still am. But I watched Lost Highway and I was like, what the hell is this? And I was like, well, that was weird. And then I didn't watch anything else from him until I got into Twin Peaks a couple years ago. Obviously obsessed with Twin Peaks. And then I watched Mulholland Drive, which it was fine. I liked it. Yeah. I'm not obsessed with it like everyone is.
Yeah.
It's fine. And then I watched Eraserhead. And when I watched Eraserhead, I saw so many parallels with Twin Peaks. And I thought, this guy bookended his career, the beginning and the end, with virtually the same, what I think is he just had a dream and he was trying to like show us these things about the dream. But I don't know why it grabs me so hard, but it does.
But you know, that's the perfect analogy. Is that you get bit and you start in and then there's so much to learn and you keep finding out more stuff and you feel like you're learning stuff and you're being entertained. It's the same with Shakespeare.
Okay.
And then with Shakespeare, it's like, it would be like everyone took Twin Peaks and remade it. Like, let's say Twin Peaks was only 3 or 4 hours long and there were 20 versions of it. That's like Shakespeare. Hamlet is actually 4 hours long. It usually gets cut to 3 hours. And imagine you could see, you know, 5 different famous actors all playing Hamlet and doing it slightly differently. That's just one aspect of Shakespeare. It gets fascinating. Oh, they did it in a castle in Scotland. Oh, they did it in an office building in Manhattan. You know, you change the setting, changes the meaning. There's that whole aspect of Shakespeare. And then there's just the plays themselves, like you find with Twin Peaks. You start going in, and there's all these cross meanings and double meanings and strange loose ends.
Huh.
But with Shakespeare, they've become like national myths. Like it's interesting that your generation is probably the first that's not really saturated in Shakespeare, but you probably can't go through the day without using an expression that came out of Shakespeare. Like it's so saturated in our interesting language.
And I don't even have a clue, probably.
And you don't even know you're saying it.
Yeah, none of my friends or family members, I mean, read Shakespeare, but I'm a dumbass that hangs out with dumbasses, I guess. I don't know. It's just not been a thing that I've ever cross paths with, and literally I think watching the Macbeth with Denzel in it was my first attempt, and I failed miserably out the gate.
you're gonna love the Polanski.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I look forward to that. I actually there's something about, because it was a movie from the 70s, I actually like 70s movies, probably, I don't know, more than any other decade. Oh, yeah. It seems 70s and 80s. Oh, something. Yeah. About the 70s movie. I like that, like, grit to it. I don't know what it is.
I agree.
So tell me about Shakespeare, because you I know we've been talking about him, but you've got a pretty comprehensive theory that there is this claim that Shakespeare actually wasn't written by a man named Shakespeare. Right. And this is where you must have friction with the cult of Shakespeare. Could you walk us through why you say that and what that means exactly?
So what I'm saying there is absolutely nothing new. It started, or if you go into the weeds, the rumors started immediately. Shakespeare was also a poet. He wrote a poem called Venus and Adonis, very sexual poem, kind of bloody. And immediately chatter started in London during the time of Queen Elizabeth. Other poets, because, like, have you ever heard of answer songs? There must be in rap answer songs. Somebody puts a track out, and then there's a diss track, and then So in the old days, we would call that answer songs. In the Elizabethan era, there'd be answer poems, and someone said, "Yo, that's Bacon. Come on." I'm paraphrasing. They said it in very elliptical language. So the rumors started immediately. They died away. In the middle of the 1800s, a woman, an American woman named Delia Bacon, no relation, realized that because, like I said, people didn't really study literature until about that time and study the life of William Shakespeare until about that time. And she put two and two together and said, these plays are so dense. There's no way this guy, William Shakespeare from Stratford-upon-Avon, wrote them, because it turns out, despite having written 36 plays and hundreds of poems, there's not a single surviving manuscript in William Shakespeare's hand. There's not a single letter from him, to him or from him at all. His parents were illiterate. He was illiterate. The only records of him are that he was a grain dealer, a real estate investor, a part-time actor, and a part-time theater owner. Since that time, further research has confirmed that nobody actually wrote about him as a writer while he was alive. And he died in 1616, and 7 years later came this big book called The First Folio, with all 36 Shakespeare plays and an introduction that suggested William Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon, the sweet swan of Avon, gentle William, wrote these plays. And then there was a civil war in England, and then the theaters were shut down, and it was only around 150 years later that his plays started to get put on regularly with a lot of attention. They were put on before that. And like I'm saying, somewhere somebody has a record of every single Shakespeare play, every time it was performed in the 1600s and 1700s and 1800s. Like, the obsession around Shakespeare is freakish. It'd be like there's a million of you, like the way you are with Twin Peaks. There'd be like hundreds of thousands of you with Shakespeare, books after books after books after books. So she said, no way could William Shakespeare have written these plays, because they're packed with ancient philosophy, ancient history, current history, medicine, law, falconry, soldiery, weather, astronomy, astrology. People didn't realize like how dense they are. They just kind of enjoyed them for the drama, which are very intense. Some of the plays are extremely violent, like shockingly violent, where women get raped and have their hands cut off and their tongue pulled out, things like that, like really intense, crazy stuff. There's comedies. He was considered the only playwright that could do comedies and tragedies. And a kind of a cult developed out of the schools, but also out of the playwrights. So if you're an actor and you learn the play, you do it night after night after night, you know, it kind of goes into your bones. So plays also were super important in the 1800s and 1900s, because there was no TV. So people went to the theater. And in England, it was pretty much all Shakespeare, wall-to-wall Shakespeare, all through the 1800s. In the early 1900s, and it's really like a cult of Shakespeare. And each play becomes sort of a world you can go into, just like Twin Peaks, that you can examine this character. And then what you'll find is the characters are extremely complex. They're psychologically really dense. There's no easy answers. There's rarely one character who's really good or really bad. And so people like Sigmund Freud were really inspired by Shakespeare. Sigmund Freud said, psychoanalysis is Shakespeare made into a science. Writers like Friedrich Nietzsche loved Shakespeare. Great music came out of Shakespeare, like the Mendelssohn Wedding March that you've heard. No, you've heard all these kind of like spin-offs from Shakespeare, because it's just been so intensely influential in our culture. Not to mention the 15,000 words he used. I think they're saying he invented over 1,000 words, many of which we use every day. They just started in Shakespeare. I should have a list of them here so I could read them, but they're just very common words. So he's had this enormous influence on our lives. And what gets really shocking is that, number one, he's got this reputation of being a balm for the soul, a humanist, you know, a lover of humanity, and even kind of a populist. But you get into the plays and you find they're actually heavily slanted towards royalty, monarchy, and the elite. He trashes commoners constantly. There's enormous hatred of women in them. Like, women are constantly tortured in these plays. And I just started noticing this extraordinary darkness in the plays. And then it started with Macbeth. That was the first one I took a good look at. And I could not believe what came out. And then since that time, that was about 3 years ago, I realized that these plays are actually tied into building the empire, that Francis Bacon wanted an empire. And so I started off with wondering how the British Empire got going and its impact on the world. And I think I found the man that literally started it. Other people take it back to John Dee. But Bacon and John Dee were very close to each other in proximity. There's very few meetings between them. I think that's because they kept it on the down low. And that Dee was the big occult guy. And then Bacon was the guy that flipped to science. Bacon's known as the father of modern science in all the history books. You can go to Wikipedia, father of modern science. He is supposedly the one that made the big shift from alchemy and magic to science. And as you know, the word chemistry comes from alchemy. And that was one of the first real sciences. But he's known as that guy. And if we fast forward to today, science is kind of ruling the world with, you know, the technocracy. So we're back in Courtney's technocracy and the dark enlightenment, as you call it, which originated with Francis Bacon because he wrote a book called New Atlantis. Probably his most famous book outside of Shakespeare, Winky Face. And that book, published the year he died, is the first ever illustration of a technocracy. It's about an island that's focused on science and where the scientists are worshipped. They're literally worshipped. It's the island of science, and science is king. And Bacon prophesied this Peter Thiel, Elon Musk technocracy Courtney's talking about, even such that Peter Thiel just gave an interview to the New York Times with this conservative op-ed writer. They have Russ Do That. He name dropped Francis Bacon 3 times, Peter Thiel. So Bacon is directly connected to this dark enlightenment. And then you put in the occult. It's all there. It's all you, man. 100%.
Well, it's interesting. I actually watched that interview and took notes on it.
Get out!
I'm trying to write a dark enlightenment book here someday here.
Oh, we should compare notes. I have notes too on it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because he talks about Francis Bacon and he even refers to this pursuit of immortality because that's, of course, the end game and that's what they want.
Yep.
Now, we're going to come right back to technocracy. I want to quick sort of button up the Shakespeare talk. Are you suggesting that Francis Bacon, because this is where I get confused here. So like Shakespeare, the person Shakespeare from Avalon or whatever his name is, do you think because there's theories that wasn't really the name of the guy who wrote this stuff. And are you saying that Francis Bacon was the guy who actually wrote all of the Shakespeare plays? Is that the idea?
William Shakespeare was a front man. He existed. He was a real person. He was in London.
Oh, okay.
But he was born and died in Stratford-upon-Avon, which is 3 miles journey from London in the old days. So he was a real person, and he was involved at that famous theater called the Globe Theater in London, whose motto was "All the world's a stage." He certainly knew Bacon. The evidence is clear that he was given a large sum of money to use his name and for him to keep his mouth shut, and he did.
Why would Francis Bacon do that? Why wouldn't he just take all the accolades?
So that's in my last essay too. Is it called "Why the Shakespeare Hoax is So Important"? Because nobody would have worshipped Francis Bacon.
Oh.
Bacon knew they needed a national poet for empire. The Greeks had a Homer. You're Greek, right?
No, my wife is.
Okay. So the Greek Empire had Homer. Everyone talked about Homer all the time. He pulled them together. That epic Iliad and the Odyssey was Greek. You know, we're Greeks. Mm. The Romans had Virgil, which actually picked up at the end of the Iliad and the battle for Troy. And the Romans feel they're descendants of the Greeks. And Virgil wrote a poem called the Aeneid, which he was the national poet of Rome. And when he wrote, it was like, "We are Romans." And he solidified Rome from the heart. You know, poetry is from the heart. And the national poets pull a nation together. And Francis Bacon, because he's so brilliant, knew that England needed a national poet. But it couldn't be him. It couldn't be anyone he knew because they were all close to the kings. It would be obvious that these plays were meant to bolster the monarchy and bolster the elite and create this sense of reverence for power and the elite that Shakespeare plays do, by the way. So he had to be a front man that you could make mythic. It had to, he had this, this front man kind of had to have a mythic, almost country boy image, almost similar to Jesus, you know, this, this nobody from nowhere who becomes the great prophet. I think William Shakespeare's myth is modeled on the story of Jesus, again, consciously by Francis Bacon, because he was so brilliant and because he knew the myths, he understood the power of myth. So we're back in the territory of Jung and Freud and the modern psychologist. Bacon was there, you know, 400 years ago, you know, which would be 200 years before Freud and Jung, the power of myth. So he created a myth. He created this myth of the country bumpkin who by divine, really by divine, they say Shakespeare had a divine inspiration. How else could it be? Like, he doesn't seem to have gone to school, or he doesn't seem to have owned any books. I can't find a single book that Shakespeare ever owned. Wow. So before people got skeptical, they were like, wow, he just, he's just English, man. He just had that, that thing. And I believe that Bacon instilled that sense of English exceptionalism that grew in the people and made them feel comfortable with building an empire. Like, this is our destiny. We are the descendants of the Greeks and the Romans. We are the English. We are destined to take over the world, and the world needs us to take them over, is actually the story they created with people like H.G. Wells and what's his name, Cecil Rhodes and Alfred Milner in the late 1800s. It reached a fever peak. They even wrote books about it called The Open Conspiracy, where, you know, English culture should dominate the planet. We're the best. And they really believe that. They, you know, it's changed a lot, of course, but that's why he didn't want the props, that it needed to go to a mythic man called William Shakespeare. And anyway, I could go on and on and on. That whole name Shakespeare is made up. The guy's real name was Shaq Spur, but it was so close to Shakespeare that he couldn't refuse. It's probably why they chose the guy. Because it could be turned into a name that was very meaningful to Francis Bacon.
That's fascinating. Yeah, that's exactly what Mr. Gates had a series called the Jupitern series way back in the day that I was into, and he talked about Shakespeare back then. I didn't pay a ton of attention to it, but I do remember him talking about the name and the derivation of it and how it was kind of concocted. So that's interesting that you would say all that, because that makes sense when you frame it that way, because I can wrap my head around how these Dark Enlightenment characters like Peter Thiel, because I think you got the same sort of metaphor, right?
Yeah.
Like, Peter Thiel wants the Dark Enlightenment, and Peter Thiel had the funds. He could have ran for president. He could have been the president. But he maybe thought, well, maybe Trump's like the archetype of someone that can be the face, because Trump's very charismatic, right?
Yeah.
And maybe he can sort of puppeteer from behind the scenes to get what he wants, which is maybe what Francis Bacon and the Empire, the British Empire, were doing with this peon named Shakespeare, I guess. So that makes sense when you put it that way, for sure.
Yeah.
And that takes us into this technocracy idea, because the you know, when I interviewed Courtney about her ideas on Plan B, you emailed me, and that's what got this ball rolling to finally get this interview on the books. My apologies.
No.
For so many years we've been talking about this, and the New Atlantis book that Francis Bacon has is about a sort of, you know, the New Atlantis. It's about a scientific technocracy that we've been talking about with the Dark Enlightenment series. Just like you said, Peter Thiel it's one of his favorite books.
Yeah, he's on record as saying that.
Tell me what you see happening. What do you think? Do you think that there's a lineage of Peter Thiel and some Illuminati insiders who are obsessed with Shakespeare and Francis Bacon and this idea of a British Empire and a New Atlantis, and he's trying to sort of implement that for this group? Or do you think this is just pure coincidence that Peter Thiel wants a technocracy government, and maybe he was, I don't know, inspired by these thoughts 400 years later?
I think we get into the era of Gnosticism now, where it's really more the elites and the commoners. And it kind of goes back to the Rosicrucians, which I think Francis Bacon was the Rosicrucian movement. There probably was an invisible college of people in that thing. I don't know how much you know about the Rosicrucians, but they're kind of.
Yeah, because they also have a sort of mythical founder, mythic. Christian Rosenkreuz, who didn't exist also.
Total mythic founder, mythic leader. And the first sentence is, we're going to change the world. The world is on the verge of reformation. I forget. The very first sentence of the first manifesto declares, you know, the world is about to change. He was talking about science, which is talking about Baconian science. Still hadn't even, it had just come out in Bacon's books. And it also talked about life extension and ending old age. Right out of the bat, the Rosicrucians are the first transhumanists. And they're really talking about technocracy and transhumanism in a very veiled way, in a mythic way, in a storytelling way. It drove everyone crazy, lit a firestorm in France and Germany, and everyone, who are these Rosicrucians? I want to meet them. I want to join them. Not one Rosicrucian ever came forth. It was all this elaborate hoax, probably based on an invisible college that included people like John Dee, Giordano Bruno, and what's his name? Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa, the great magician. So I think Peter Thiel's part of that tradition of the self-made elect. I don't know if he's part of a secret society that teaches that, which is what Freemasonry teaches, that you are special, you're part of the elect, you know, which is what British exceptionalism taught those people that came out of, but they're called public schools in England, but we would call them private schools, boarding schools. You're special, you know, you have special blood, that whole bloodline thing. You're British, you're the elect, you deserve to rule the world. This sense that you're special and elect is a Gnostic concept, which is the religion began around the time of Christ and is probably the only really, really original religious idea, because most religious ideas are recycled. Even this idea of a one God, other cultures have had that idea. There's just one God. But the Gnostics believe that the God that created this world was evil and created this world to trap our souls here. That there's another God beyond that God who's the real God. He's just so distant that he kind of doesn't know what's happening over here on Earth. He kind of dropped the ball, but that's cool because he created everything and he's the God. And the sun represents that God, not the creator God. And the creator God has built this world of death and evil that is a prison. They literally believe this, the Gnostics, so that they're justified in tearing down the world if they want, or trying to escape it in any way, or understanding that there's no distinction between good and evil. So there's no conventional morality is another aspect of Gnosticism. And that religion had many different sects. And I think it definitely connects through to Elizabethan England. There's Queen Elizabeth there. One of the earliest Gnostic sects were the Ophites, also known as the Naasines, which means snake or serpent in Greek. So there you'll see Queen Elizabeth with the serpent on her arm, which I think is a reference to Gnosticism. And it doesn't mean they're evil. It doesn't mean they're Satanists. It doesn't mean they sign their name in blood. It does mean that they think they are the elect. And then from there, there's all sorts of permutations and types of sects that believe in this stuff. And I do think Peter Thiel is part of that sect, and how he's connected to it, I don't know. It could be that he thinks everyone should live forever, but he was so brokenhearted in that interview that Baconian science had stopped advancing and just didn't look like he was going to live forever. Right? Did you get that vibe?
Yeah, he seemed like he was really upset about how technology wasn't accelerating at the pace he wanted it to. Yeah. And he's like frantic to, you know, make sure we roll out AI as fast as humanly possible, which is what we're seeing with, you know, our global governments everywhere is fueling up AI as fast as they possibly can. And it's I go back and forth on whether or not I think that's actually dangerous or not, because part of me, when I use AI, I think, wow, that's really impressive. I can see how this thing could evolve to appear sentient at some point. But then part of me also thinks these are the nerds that watch science fiction and believe it wholeheartedly. And they, you know, 100 years ago, they thought we were going to be living on Mars and out in the living on other planets, which I don't think is possible. Or
I don't either.
So I don't know. I go back and forth with.
We are stuck here. We can't leave. It's true.
You know, and I don't know if I don't know. Sometimes, I mean, if you forced me to pick, I do believe there that it's possible they're going to find some kind of digital matrix plan where we can, you know, replicate reality so well that you put on this little Neuralink cap and you can live not immortally or eternally, but you can live in a goo pod like the Matrix. And I think that's possible. I don't know though.
I don't.
No, you're firmly against that idea.
Dude, scientists don't know how a single thought comes into our brain because we're just a chemical soup. Not one thought.
That's a good point.
They don't know why we sleep. Talk about dreams. They don't know how or why we dream. They don't know how memories are formed. They don't know why we sleep. I mean, they're so full of themselves to think they're that close. It's comical, but it's also scary because they're making these machines that, you know, these bombs, 24-hour surveillance. It's like, have fun with your toys. Just don't, you know, don't destroy us. And don't try to make a prison. The irony is that they think the world is a prison, so they're making the world a prison.
Absolutely. Yeah, that connection isn't lost on me at all. I think the same things. In fact, when I talk to my wife about all this stuff, because she talks a lot to her ChatGPT, and...
Oh, no.
And the chat, you know, it depends. If we get to the point where we believe AI is actually some form of consciousness that we've created, then we have to accept that, if we do accept that, we have to accept also that we've created a sort of slave consciousness to just do our bidding, which is problematic. Mm-hmm. And that's where this thought came out from that conversation was, oh, so the nerds who believe in all this Gnostic stuff in a simulation world, they've become the demiurge. They've created a slave consciousness with their AI.
Correct. Yeah. And it's funny you say consciousness. That's the other thing that really is who we are. That
you're right that also they can't define what is consciousness as well.
No idea. And these clowns like Ray Kurzweil, who thinks his consciousness will be downloaded into a digital matrix. It's so preposterous and absurd. It's ridiculous, but he, on the other hand, is a brilliant scientist who makes all these predictions, and he, you know, the material, it's great. The science is great for the material world and making creature comforts and rockets and airplanes. But as soon as you get to biology, then as soon as you get to psychology and metaphysics, it's lost. And that's really what life is, really, is our feelings and our thoughts at the end of the day, which is why literature is so great and cinema is so great and David Lynch is so great, because, you know, he's talking about these deeper things, feelings and thoughts and myths and dreams that science hasn't got a clue about.
Yeah, I'm with you on that 100%. I think that because it, you know, I had a weird experience. I was really into science going to college for engineering, and I was really intrigued by science fiction movies, and, you know, so in a way I was kind of in that realm to some degree. But the more I you know, the older I get, the more I can kind of get exposed to a variety of things. And I think, man, these nerds have got it so wrong. And for instance, there's a clip that I saw. I don't know what show it was on. Neil deGrasse Tyson was talking to somebody, and there was a discussion about science, and I'm assuming they were talking about the pandemic and how the scientists wanted us all to, you know, take the thing that they said was going to save our entire existence, and which turned out not so much. And Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, the eternal science optimist, was saying something like, well, look, you know, a couple hundred years ago, the average life expectancy was 35 years old. And, you know, today it's 80 or whatever. And the implication that I'm paraphrasing is he's like, well, we have to thank science for that. And it's like, well, the science also shows that you guys are coming up with this average life of 35, because back then, you know, babies didn't make it past 5 years old. Most of them didn't make it, mm-hmm. which, to be fair, science is what sort of arguably what made, you know, the higher, what do you call it, infant mortality rate change.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's misleading to pretend that, what, nobody lived to 80 back then?
Like, right.
No, everyone still, you know, is basically living the same life expectancy. And these scientists, the point they use to try to sort of pat themselves on the back is total BS.
Well, they're trying to blow science up out of its lane. They're trying to take science and make it scientism, which makes, well, they want us to believe that science is the greatest thing ever happened to humanity, and science can solve all our problems, and science is truth. Science is way cool. I love science too. You know, I still read up on the new science, and I have friends that are scientists, but they're also aware of what scientism is. And scientism is the new Atlantis. Scientism is technocracy. Scientism is why everyone took the jabby stabby, because a scientist said it was good. And it's just false. Science is amazing for the material world, pretty okay for biology, although as soon as you get into the human biology, good science is really hard to do. So they essentially lie about it, and it's really easy to lie with science. You just fudge your data. You tell them, right. Hey, I did this experiment. Here, take this. This is going to make you better. Look, here's the data. Right. And you just made the data up. But we've been taught to trust scientists. Nobody says trust in God anymore. Trust the science. But I say, don't trust the science. You know, verify it. Verify, verify, verify. If you love science, you know, verify it, because there's a lot of fake science out there. And it's really hard to expose fake science, because these Gnostics have a control of a big chunk of the media, which is programming us to believe in science as sort of some ultimate power, when it's really just a mechanism to kind of make us more comfortable. And I'm sure, yeah, I mean, a lot, they want us to think that the stabby jabbies extended our life, but it was really refrigeration and running water.
Right. Yeah. I've unpacked all of that.
It's not the stabby jabbies.
I had a friend who told me all that, who was arguing this years ago with me. And when 2020 happened, I finally had a good excuse to actually dig into the information. And, you know, as you probably are aware, I did a series on it, which I've taken down, because my conclusion was, first off, that the science isn't so black and white that, like, oh yeah, everyone's fine, everyone should do the same solution.
Yeah.
And I think it's a personal choice. I think you're rolling the dice either way. It's up to you as to which way you want that to go. And, like, I don't want to be involved in anyone's choice, which is why I took those down.
Interesting.
But you're right. Like, I asked him that specific thing. I was like, well, what about you know, polio or whatever, and I read some stuff about the you know, the history of sanitation, and how you know, you watch those old timey movies and they're drinking water in the same place they take a dump and stuff, and you're like, well, geez, no wonder everyone was sick as hell. it's a very, very very strange time we're living through, and I'm curious as to what the next 10 years will bring, and which side of the argument will turn out to be correct on what the future looks like for AI, and if they can really put us in a digital matrix. And I'm not sure what to think. I could go to either side of that argument, but anyway, I see we're running out of time. So I do want to hit you up with, when does this book come out? What's next for you? That kind of thing. I know you've been working on this book for a minute.
Yeah. Well, the next stage is I'm working on putting into essay form, and I'll do a podcast too of all the evidence showing that Francis Bacon is responsible for creating modern Freemasonry, which half of that is done, which if you go to Substack or Patreon, you can read how Freemasonry originated in Scotland. So we're kind of back to Scotland and Macbeth. And that's going to be the final puzzle. And I'm just going to stop because the research on the book can be endless. Mm. I'm going to finish up Midsummer Night's Dream. I mean, just to do one Shakespeare play takes weeks and weeks and weeks because their plays are so dense. And you kind of need to read at least a decent amount of what other people have said about the play.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah.
Because it's so dense and confusing. They're purposely confusing the plays while still being moving, which a lot of great art is. You know, it's kind of not quite sure what it's about, but you're moved by it anyway. So I'm just going to draw the line, finish Midsummer Night's Dream, finish the evidence for Freemasonry. And the book is mostly written, but not in book form. So it kind of needs to be assembled, needs a good introduction. But it's pretty close to being done, you know? So I'm very excited about it.
Tell us where we can learn more, where we can follow you so we can get updates on the book and so on. I know you got a podcast. You said you got a Patreon and you got a Substack. What's the tags for those so I can put them in the show notes for everybody?
Patreon, The Hidden Life is Best. The deep dives into the Shakespeare plays are behind a $5 a month paywall. Same on Substack. I just let the essays out there for free. Please check them out if you're interested. It's kind of built up to quite a collection of essays, I guess, when I look at it. Some of them are pretty long, but they're about this kind of a cult element existing in Shakespeare and Francis Bacon and the British Empire. A lot of what you deal with, but kind of the OG. I see Shakespeare as the OG of what you do with pop culture. It's really dense with the cult symbolism. So there's The Hidden Life is Best on Patreon and The Hidden Life is Best on Substack. I would greatly appreciate your support. It gives me a lot of encouragement. I definitely, if I didn't have my Patreons and supporters, I wouldn't be able to keep going if I wasn't bringing in some income from this. I would just look like completely nuts. And, you know, my wife wouldn't be too happy. So the support is really great. I love all my patrons and subscribers, but if you can't afford the $5 a month, just sign up as a free subscriber on Patreon or Substack and you'll get essays and alerts to what's going on. And a lot of it is contemporary because this stuff really impacts our current world, which is why I'm doing it. I'm not doing it just to expose the Shakespeare hoax. It's because of that hoax and the scientism associated with it, because I do think they're connected. We didn't get a chance to talk about that, to this modern world. And that's why I'm doing it. So become a subscriber. And thanks a million, Isaac. It's been really fun.
Yeah, this is great. I'm so happy we finally got together for the first time here. I'm sure we'll get back together here once your book drops and I can read through it and try to make some sense of it. So
fantastic.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your thoughts and thanks for doing all this research, man. You're doing some heavy lifting out there, so much respect for that.
Thanks.
So yeah, but thanks for joining us, and I'll put the links in the show notes for everybody. I'm off to go watch Polanski's Macbeth right now.
All right, have fun. Take it
all right,
easy,
buddy.
Man.
All right, bye. Cheers. There you go. I don't know about you, but I am very intrigued. I'm going to start looking into Shakespeare. I was talking to Robert after we recorded, and I thought, man, I don't know, but you might fuel a new obsession for me. This might be my new Twin Peaks. I don't know. I'm a little scared. I'm a little nervous. But I'm going to start with Polanski's Macbeth and see how that sits. And then we'll see what happens. So, again, check out Robert Frederick's podcast, The Hidden Life is Best. Same name for the Substack. Same name for the Patreon. Links are in the show notes. Thank you for listening to the show. Appreciate you all. Till next time, stay positive.